A federal judge says it's no longer a crime to go undercover at factory farms. This hour, why Iowa's so-called ag gag law has been struck down. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also today, we'll hear about the nightmares the shutdown is causing for some Iowans. Congressman Steve King now faces a primary challenger and a potential censure motion from congressional Democrats for using racist language. Is Northeast Iowa a trove of valuable minerals? We'll talk about that and a conversation with Governor Kim Reynolds on the eve of the new legislative session. Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the president's battle with congressional Democrats to approve funding for a physical barrier, that wall, that border wall, continues. And that impasse looks like it will result in the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. That would happen this weekend should the shutdown continue. Again, approximately 800,000 federal workers have been furloughed or are being required to work without pay. And the shutdown, as we've been hearing in coverage on NPR, here on IPR, it's touching the lives of Americans in a myriad of ways, as we've been hearing. My next guest has been hearing from a number of his clients for whom the shutdown has caused some real problems. Tyler Coe joins us from the studio in Des Moines, associate attorney at Whitfield and Eddy Law Firm in Des Moines. He's a family law attorney. Tyler, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
What stories are you hearing from your clients connected with this shutdown?
Sure. A lot of my clients are very, very concerned. They're not receiving pay. They're not sure how they're going to pay their household bills, their spousal support, if so ordered, child support, if they have kids. Some are going through the process. And so not only are they dealing with the stress of their divorce, their child custody action, whatever it may be, but they're now dealing with something that's completely out of their control that they didn't sign up for, yet they're still required to work.
Mm-hmm. While respecting attorney-client privilege there, can you share one instance that may make it clear to listeners who don't have a connection with this government funding, who haven't felt what this can do to a person, to a family?
Sure. One client of mine, this individual receives child support. They're not receiving spousal support at this time because that's how the court ruled during temporary matters. This person's very concerned. How are they going to pay their mortgage payment? How are they going to provide for their children? Are we going to have to go back to court, spend more attorney fees that, but for the shutdown, would not be necessary? Will they now have to ask a judge to reconsider this previous ruling so they can afford to live? It's just, you know, an average Iowan forced into this position.
Mm-hmm. And you've talked personally with some of these clients.
Yes, at least five in my firm.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an idea of the emotional state of these people, what this stress is causing?
Right. One just the other day called me crying toward the end of the day. This person had just gotten off work, working without pay, as you know. And at that point, I'm more of a counselor than an attorney, trying to figure out what the best route is to move forward, if they can move forward, and what to do. They're pinned down. They're not sure how they're going to provide for their family, how they're going to meet their court-ordered obligations, where they could get in trouble if they don't meet them.
Mm-hmm. So what are the questions here that are in your mind about the courts? How do the courts deal with this, I guess, almost unprecedented situation?
Sure. So that's a great question. At my firm, we have quite a large family law practice, and so we've been meeting with each other informally, trying to figure out what's the best route to treat this. Some, if the divorce process is only, you know, midway through or even at a starting point, do we go back to a court if there has been an order entered and say, Your Honor, please listen to this story. There's actually no income coming in right now. The trick is, an order has already been entered in a lot of these cases for temporary matters or even final matters. How long will the shutdown last? A judge, it's really hard for them to make a decision. They're not in an easy spot because they don't know how long this thing will last, when it will end, and what to do next.
Mm-hmm. So let's say, you know, we don't know, no idea when this government shutdown will end. Could be tomorrow, could be next week, it could be weeks from now. When the government does reopen after this partial shutdown, do all the problems go away, or is that time for a real cleanup, so to speak?
Sure, that's an excellent question. So it will be looked up as more of a cleanup because, one, bills haven't been paid, spousal support hasn't been paid, child support hasn't been paid. Has the other party who maybe does or does not have a job that's not impacted by the federal government, have they filed something in court, such as a contempt action, trying to get the other party in trouble for not meeting their court-ordered obligations? And will my clients who are impacted by this shutdown, will they get the back pay? That's a huge concern. They mm-hmm. don't know.
Right, right. And though you work, you're a family law attorney, this affects businesses. Some of your clients have private businesses that has to impact there as well.
Yes, it does. I mean, we have clients everywhere from agriculture, the farm service agency, people. My clients get loans from the farm service agency. There's professors I represent who applied for federal grants they're not receiving. I have small business owners who rely on them. Another client works for the Federal Department of Labor, an organization associated with that entity. And it's just really frustrating because it's not just their one small aspect of the divorce. It's their entire lives that are being upended.
Okay, Tyler Coe, Associate Attorney at Whitfield & Eddy Law in Des Moines, a family law attorney. Tyler, thanks for coming in to give us a perspective from your corner there about the woes that many Iowans are facing now with this partial government shutdown. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A federal judge in Iowa says it's no longer a crime to go undercover at factory farms, slaughterhouses, I think even puppy mills, any other ag-related operations. Senior Judge James Gritzner granted a summary judgment on this past Wednesday to a group that sued over this law. It said that the 2012 law, and this is the law that's known as the Ag Gag Law, was a clear violation of the First Amendment. Here to give us some background and explain this ruling, Jennifer Zwagerman is Associate Director of the Agricultural Law Center at Drake University and will be the director of the center starting in the summer. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Start by giving us perhaps some background on this law quickly. What it stipulates, why it was enacted in 2012.
Iowa was one of a number of states that enacted similar laws in response to a series of undercover investigations that occurred in the years prior to that. And fairly dramatic video footage came out of those that was obviously extremely negative to the industry, brought a lot of negative attention. And the laws were passed in part to try and not prevent that type of activity, but to prevent the way it occurred in the sense that people were obtaining employment under false pretenses. They would lie, provide false information, enter facilities that they would not have access to otherwise. And the goal was to prevent that type of employment from occurring.
Mm-hmm. Right. I remember these horrendous videos, too, at least one particular in memory of some, you know, newborn male chicks being just dumped into what was a grinder to just end their lives, right?
It was, and it was horrible to see and very disturbing.
Mm-hmm. So this particular case comes about how?
Well, there were a number of groups, including the ACLU and the Animal Legal Defense Fund and others that had filed this lawsuit challenging the law under First Amendment grounds, saying it was unconstitutional to try and prevent this type of free speech and that the criminal penalties were and the threat of them were preventing these types of undercover operations from occurring within our state.
Mm-hmm. And the judge so I had to look at the question. The central question here is what this violates the First Amendment. How, possibly?
Well, and it's hard to really, I guess, understand at times the idea that lying can be protected under the First Amendment. Mm. But essentially, that's what it comes down to here, is that unless there is some sort of material gain by the person who is lying, or some sort of significant harm, lying itself is a form of protected speech that people can engage in. Mm-hmm. And because of that, any laws that the state would pass or a government would pass that would infringe upon that right need to be both targeted at a specific problem that the state is trying to address, a significant problem, and it also needs to be directly addressing that problem. And the judge basically said in this case that the ability to lie on your application in the sense that it was meant here is protected speech, and that the law itself was not aimed and specifically targeting issues in a way that it would prevent them.
Mm-hmm. What happens now? Is this the final word? Is the ag-gag law history?
It is not necessarily the last word. The state has a chance to appeal this decision to the Eighth Circuit, and we may see that. Iowa is not the first state to have these laws overturned and or found unconstitutional. Utah and Idaho have seen similar activities and lawsuits. North Carolina has one currently pending, as does Kansas right now. And so it is very possible that we will see an appeal occur here. And when that goes up to the Eighth Circuit, we'll see what other states may see. If the Eighth Circuit were to overturn this and remand it back to the court, that would set up a split in the circuits between the Ninth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit. Mm-hmm. And then we might even see an appeal up to the Supreme Court.
Mm. And then they would have to decide whether they take the case, or in the case of a split, which decision stands.
It would be. And you're more likely, I mean, there's no guarantee that the Supreme Court would take it, even if there was a split in the circuits.
Mm-hmm.
But when you see differences like that, you're more likely to see them consider it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so until that time, after this ruling, what is the status of if someone wants to lie on an application and wants to reveal what they think are practices in some sort of ag-related industry here in Iowa that they think is violating the law, can they make that application, try to get that employment, to do some undercover video work?
They certainly could, but that doesn't mean that you can do that without risk of any penalty either. There are still trespass laws in the state that may apply in situations like this, between private property rights and other types of laws that were already on the books.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to this, there are still potential penalties out there if you improperly gain entrance to an animal facility, or what might be more appropriate here, you might be invited into the facility as an employee, but if you access records that you were not supposed to have access to, or if you access parts of the property and take video that you should not have access to or would not have access to as part of the job you've mm-hmm. been hired to do, then there may still be penalties and issues attached to that type of activity.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, Jennifer, I'm just curious, do other industries outside of the agriculture industry here in Iowa or perhaps in other states enjoy this type of protection, the protection afforded by the so-called ag-gag law?
In Iowa, we don't typically see the breadth of this type of protection in other industries. And that was one of the types of issues that you see when people challenge it, is that why does agriculture receive this higher level of protection than nursing homes or hospitals or daycare centers or anything like that? But other states do give that. North Carolina's law, which is currently being challenged right now, their way of trying to avoid some of the concerns that have been argued with this was to make it widely applicable. And so their state law does make it apply to nursing homes, hospitals, daycares, and a host of other types of businesses and operations, not just agricultural facilities.
Okay, fascinating. Thank you for background and your expertise here. Jennifer Zwagerman is Associate Director of the Agricultural Law Center at Drake University, talking about the ruling this week, a federal judge saying it's no longer a crime to go undercover at factory farms and other ag-related operations. lying, I guess, to put it in short form, is a protected part of free speech. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A couple of developments on the political landscape here in Iowa this week to discuss with one of our regular political analysts. Dennis Goldford has stepped into our studio, professor of political science and department chair at Drake University. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Oh, you're on our phone. Very good. Just as well. Let's talk in the few minutes we have here about Representative King. Congressman King, a Republican of the 4th District, facing potential censure motion from congressional Democrats after using what is seen as racist language in a New York Times interview this week. He questioned in this interview the terms white nationalist, white supremacist, and Western civilization, how they became offensive. Denunciations to these remarks in the New York Times from his own party, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. King issuing a statement rejecting the labels of white nationalism and white supremacy. He called himself a nationalist, and he said that the fact that he's an advocate for Western civilization values does not mean he subscribes to the evil ideology, in his words, of white supremacy. To hitch on to this, before your comment, Dennis, Iowa State Senator Randy Feenstra launching a primary challenge against King this week, arguing that King's caustic nature, his words there, has left residents of Iowa's 4th Congressional District without, in his words, a seat at the table. Your thoughts?
Well, of course, Congressman King has always been a politician who, despite a very polite and pleasant demeanor, has tended to say rather inflammatory things. This goes back for 20 years to the time he was working for Official English in the Iowa State Senate. But there was always the question on the part of Democrats as to two kinds of criticisms of Representative King. One was that in a legislative sense, he really wasn't getting anything done, at least so they claimed, for Iowa as a state or the 4th District and used to be the 5th District in particular. The other criticism was that he was becoming an embarrassment to the state of Iowa, if not the 4th or the old 5th District. Those were claims Democrats always made. But increasingly, we've come to see, particularly late last fall, Republicans starting to raise those issues. And you'll note that Mr. Feenstra is not attempting to come at Steve King from the left, if you will, from a more liberal side, although that's what Congressman King's spokespeople seem to be suggesting. Rather, Mr. Feenstra wants to campaign as almost Trumpier than Donald Trump, certainly Trumpier than Steve King. And the argument that he's made so far as they've been able to determine it, has been that the inflammatory comments that Congressman King has been making have been getting in the way of his being an effective party regular on behalf of President Trump.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the new environment for Steve King in the House now that it's under Democratic control. I see Representative Tim Ryan, he's a Democrat from Ohio, said King's latest comments exhibit, quote, a pattern of behavior that is worthy of a censure. What could happen here?
Well, the Democrats, with a majority in the House, could indeed vote to censure Congressman King for those comments. They might want to do that simply because they believe the sorts of things he says are completely outside the legitimate mainstream of American politics. But there's always a political angle as well. They can make Republicans go on record as to whether they support the kinds of concepts the Congressman comments that Congressman King makes, or whether they reject them, as a few Republicans have done so far. So it puts Republicans potentially in a tight spot.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about another Iowa political story this week. Billionaire investor, Democratic activist Tom Steyer, this was Wednesday in Des Moines, says he's not going to run for the White House in 2020, and instead he's going to focus on calling for President Trump's impeachment. Just a reminder, Steyer has spent $50 million dollars on his need to impeach campaign. That's what it's called. He announced plans to spend $40 million more this year at that event in Des Moines this week. He said at that event, quote, the impeachment question has reached an inflection point. Given that the Democrats have taken control of the House. So what does this do? Does this put pressure on the House Democrats, where there's a real divide, isn't there, about how to proceed and using the I word even.
Right. The I word is, we use the following term quite often, the nuclear option. But the I word, the possibility of drawing up articles of impeachment against the sitting president, is indeed a nuclear option. There are elements of the Democratic Party that want to do that. Certainly Steyer is playing toward them. On the other hand, right now, barring something really significant coming out of the Mueller investigations, there seems to be nothing at this point in President Trump's behavior or policies that would cause Senate Republicans to vote to convict him. So at best, we would get tremendous blowback by from Trump supporters against the Democratic House if they voted articles of impeachment. So some Democrats want to say that either you don't want to talk about that yet, or at least it's premature until we see what comes out of the Mueller investigations. But it really is playing not just with fire, but with nuclear weapons when you talk about possibly impeaching a president.
Right. And we know the new House Speaker, Democrat Nancy Pelosi, first of all, she runs a tight ship and she has a lot of experience, and that she has said, and I think numerous times, the House shouldn't move to impeach Trump without more facts, and that effort would be divisive. She's right?
Right, and we have to remember that the last time a president was impeached and went to trial before the Senate with President Clinton, the Democrats actually gained seats after that failed impeachment attempt. And so Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to have a case in which the Republicans were to gain seats after a Democratic attempt to impeach President Trump, again, barring something really earth-shaking from the Mueller investigation.
Dennis, before we let you go, we're coming up on a break in a minute and a half or 2 minutes. Let's get your thoughts on the shutdown. Of course, the big question nobody knows the answer to, when will it end? Unless you have some line of information I don't. Well, what are your thoughts at this point as we go into the weekend? And on the weekend, if it continues, it will become the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, right?
Right. And the president has painted himself into a corner because essentially the people who are furloughed, who are not getting paychecks, have nothing to do with any of this. So they're being held hostage in pursuit of the president's dedication to creating, being able to tell his supporters he kept a campaign promise and receive funding to build a wall. That's his signature issue. And if he goes back on that in any way, he's in trouble with that base, who otherwise protect him from any possibility of impeachment with support from Republicans. So he can't be seen to go back on that, yet he's got to find a way out of that. And while the Democrats say no, he's got no other option at this point than to attempt to make this move toward an emergency declaration.
Dennis, in 30 seconds, which of our congressional delegation members are feeling the pressure most as this shutdown continues?
I think they're all feeling it because this hurts everybody, regardless of party, but that puts Republicans in a tighter spot since Democrats have already argued we should simply have a clean bill to vote to reopen the government, refund those agencies, and deal with the wall issue separately.
Okay, Dennis Goldford, Professor of Political Science, Department Chair at Drake University. Dennis, always great to have you on and to hear your insightful analysis.
It's always a pleasure, Ben.
Coming up in just a few minutes after a short break here on our News Buzz edition of River to River. Wow, this is interesting. A geology find in our news. Is Northeast Iowa a trove of valuable minerals? Well, possibly. We'll find out. Also, a conversation with Governor Kim Reynolds coming up on the eve of the new legislative session. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end our news week here at Iowa Public Radio. A research team from the University of Iowa is investigating whether a region in the northeast part of the state may be a repository of precious minerals, and that could be an economic boon to the state. Joining us, Ryan Clark, is geologist with the Iowa Geological Survey, housed at the University of Iowa, part of IIHR, Hydroscience and Engineering at the University of Iowa. Ryan Clark, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I love geology. I'm so glad it's in the news. What is the region you and other geologists have been researching here?
It's the extreme northeast corner of the state. The complex that we're looking at and has been covered in the recent articles underlies about 10 counties in the northeastern part of the state.
Mm-hmm. What cities would these counties encompass there?
You're looking at Decorah and then down south towards like Elkader, Manchester, and then as far to the south as Vinton.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what has been found so far? What are the indications so far that there are precious minerals?
Starting in the 60s, the state had been flown to do geophysical surveys.
Surveyed by plane.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the best way to describe the geophysics is almost like taking an X-ray of the Earth. It's looking down through the soil and the sands and gravels and even through all the sedimentary rocks, the limestones and sandstones.
You can do that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. They could do that even back in the 60s. And so some features had showed up even back then that they were aware of. A few, you know, research projects had stemmed from those areas in the 70s, and some of those didn't really go anywhere. So we've known of this area for a while, but it wasn't until the USGS got a hold of this and wanted to investigate a little bit further here as recent as 2012 up to currently.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what makes you and the other geologists think this might be a trove of valuable minerals? And we're talking not only hundreds of feet below the surface, but thousands of feet below the surface, right?
Yeah, correct. So it all stems from a really large old feature in the Earth's crust in this part of the country called the Mid-Continent Rift. It's a place where, you know, the country actually tried to rip itself apart about 1.1 billion years ago. That feature extends from Kansas through Iowa all the way up underneath Lake Superior and around into Michigan. Along that rift, there are magmatic bodies, these deposits of what used to be molten rock. Again, they're a billion years old or more. And along the Lake Superior area, those are generating a lot of minerals that are being exploited up in those areas now. And now we're just kind of looking at, well, we seem to have a similar sort of setup here in northeast Iowa, mm-hmm. but it's covered under 2,000 feet of other rock.
Okay, so up north, there's a similar area, and we're saying, and this is an area near Duluth, right?
Yeah, known as the Duluth Complex. It's kind of the western shore of Lake Superior. Mm-hmm.
And they have been mining valuable minerals there. They have found valuable minerals, and we think the same geological forces going back a billion or more years also impacted northeast Iowa.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's where the USGS has kind of taken the lead to try and see, is there another analog to this Duluth complex? And they believe that northeast Iowa could be that analog.
I understand at the Oakdale campus of the University of Iowa out in Coralville, there's been the analysis of a nearly half-mile-long core sample that was taken from near Elkader. Tell us about that.
We've actually got an entire warehouse full of core samples and rock chip samples. It's an excellent treasure in and of itself. But the core that we've been looking at related to this project, it was drilled in 1963 by New Jersey Lead and Zinc Corporation. They were looking for iron at the time. They had used geophysics to tell them where they were going to drill. So they drilled this core that ended up being 2,560 feet deep. They didn't encounter the rocks that we're investigating until 1,837 feet. So they had to drill through 1,800 feet of limestone and sandstone first.
This core is, well, intact scientifically, so that you know which part of the core is above the other part. So you can, I mean, it's like a history book back into our geological history, right?
Yes, it's a complete, full-depth, intact core. We have half of it. New Jersey Zinc kept the other half. And it's just stored in boxes in our rock library. So, you know, you can pull out 10 feet at a time and see the different changes that go through that rock as the drill went down.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's looking at this, what turns out to be about 720 feet of this material that we call, it's Precambrian in age. It's that billion-year-old stuff. Taking a look at that and trying to get minerals out of it that might be analyzed for an age date.
Mm-hmm. What are the most precious minerals we can hope for here that have been perhaps detected?
Well, using the other deposits like the Duluth Complex and others in the Lake Superior area as an analog, we're looking at potential for platinum group elements, which are platinum, palladium, iridium, things like that. Maybe possibly gold, silver, but the other options would be copper and nickel. Those types of minerals are what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. And valuable. I have my cell phone on my side. I have a television or a monitor in front of me. Computers everywhere these days. These are valuable minerals for these instruments.
Exactly. The demand for these types of minerals is only going up with technology and renewable energy and things like that. So exactly, with that demand going up, the need to find not only more of those, but we would like to have them be domestically sourced
mm-hmm.
for a lot of, you know, social, economic, political reasons.
Right, right. And isn't it true that some of these rare earth minerals, and I don't know if any of them are found here in that category, you know, some countries really have the market on it, and we don't produce a lot of them here in the United States out of our soil, right?
Absolutely. And that's again, what's driving the impetus for this from the USGS perspective is they've got, you know, the push from the current administration to get an idea of what do we have domestically so that we don't have to go and buy these minerals from other countries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I wonder if you can sort of be a futurist here, give us an idea of what it might be like in terms of mining operations in the future if this prospecting, this high-tech prospecting, turns out to have really positive results.
Of course. Obviously, I'm not a mining engineer or an economist by any stretch of the imagination, but I could say safely that this is all going to be underground mining if it ever does develop. It's going to happen 2,000 feet or more below the ground surface, and that means that there wouldn't be giant open pit mines scarring the landscape.
Right.
So I think that would be, you know, sort of the first thing to get across.
Mm-hmm. Is that okay? So that to our environment, very low impact. There'd be a structure, and then you'd just be all the work would take place hundreds and thousands of feet below the surface.
Right. I suppose in theory, if I had to guess, it would be industrial structures for processing things like that. Maybe some storage, you know, tailings piles or something like that. But it's kind of hard to say at this point. But the bulk of the work would happen way deep down.
Okay. Very interesting news from way deep down in northeast Iowa. Ryan Clark, geologist with the Iowa Geological Survey, housed at the University of Iowa. Ryan, thanks so much for the conversation.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, in just a moment, to finish up the hour, we'll listen to a conversation that IPR's Clay Masters and Katarina Sestarik had with Governor Kim Reynolds from a few days ago. But first, let's talk with our legislative reporter on the eve of a new session, IPR State House reporter Katarina Sestarik. Hi.
Hi, Ben.
So yesterday, I understand, Katarina, you attended a legislative forum. What did you discover about the agenda for the new session, which begins next week?
Republican legislative leaders said they want to address taxes again. Last year, there was a sweeping income tax bill that cut taxes for multiple levels of income. There were a lot of things in that bill. This year, they want to look at property taxes. They said mm-hmm. they've heard some voters who are confused that their property tax bills are going up, but they're hearing that their taxes are supposed to be cut. So they said they want to look at some options for lowering property tax bills, but they don't have any finalized legislation at this time. There was also a lot of talk about the Supreme Court. There have been some major rulings by the Iowa Supreme Court recently that some conservative Iowans have been not very happy with. And Republican leaders and the governor sent a message yesterday that they want to consider changing the system for choosing who's on the Supreme Court. So the Senate Majority Leader, Jack Whitver, he sort of took issue with the fact that half of the commission that selects nominees for the court is made up of attorneys chosen by other attorneys. And he said that perhaps more of those seats should be opened up to the public, but that would also possibly give elected officials a larger role in the process. Any major overhaul of the system would require a constitutional amendment, so they're trying to work within the way the Constitution is currently written. And the House Democratic leader, Todd Pritchard, said that politicizing the judiciary is the worst thing they could do, and he said they should protect the merit-based system that exists right now.
Okay, Katarina, anything else you see on the legislative agenda?
Both parties said they want to discuss workforce development and investing in rural Iowa. That might involve putting additional funding into existing programs. There's always mentions of health care. There was a major mental health law that passed last year, but they want to discuss more sustainable funding and possibly creating a children's mental health system. And also, Governor Reynolds has been hinting at criminal justice reform, but she hasn't revealed any details, and that'll be part of her condition of the state address on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. And this will be part of our discussion, Katarina, when you and I talk with a number of legislative leaders from both parties on Monday, won't it? You mentioned Jack Whitfer, the senator, Republican Senate Majority Leader, also Todd Pritchard, Democrat, the House Minority Leader, will be joining us on Monday with some others, right?
Right. We'll also have Republican House Majority Leader Chris Hagenow and Senate Minority Leader Janet Peterson, a Democrat.
Okay. We're looking forward to that on Monday. We're going to listen to your conversation, the one that you and Clay had with Governor Kim Reynolds, in just a moment to finish off our hour. But before we do, do you think this year will be similar or different from the governor's first session in office, Katarina?
This is the first session in which Governor Reynolds has been elected to a full term. And so IPR asked her how she might do things differently. But she said she highlighted Republican accomplishments from the last year, and she said she wants to continue going in that direction. So I'm not sure that there will be anything super different. She said she's happy with how things have been going and wants to keep going in that direction.
Okay. Until Monday, IPR Statehouse reporter Katarina Sestarek. Thanks.
Thanks, Ben.
Let's now take a listen to a portion of Katarina Sestarek's and Clay Masters' interview with Governor Reynolds, who was recorded last Thursday, the 3rd of January.
So now you've been elected to your first full term as governor. How do you want to make your mark in this job?
Oh, listen, I'm excited to have 4 years to really work on keeping Iowa moving in the right direction to continue to grow the economy. I'm excited about the strength and, you know, where the success and where Iowa is at. Our economy is strong. We have a balanced budget. Our cash reserves are fuller than when I took office in 2011, and we have $127 million surplus. So that's a better position to be in as we move into this next legislative session. And we continue to see the economy grow. As I talk to businesses across the state, they still remain optimistic. It just comes down to, you know, workers. And so that's a tremendous opportunity, I believe, for Iowans. And we're, through Future Ready Iowa, looking forward to helping them get the skills and then matching them up with great job opportunities across the state of Iowa. But, you know, we continue to see we're second lowest cost of doing business, third best managed state. As I said, 4 quarters of income growth, that wage increases, that's exciting. That lagged. We hadn't seen that happening. And so to have 4 straight quarters, I think they just released a report not too long ago where, you know, every county except for 3 saw significant income growth. So especially in rural Iowa, I was really excited to see that. I think Sioux County had an increase of about 20%, and O'Brien and Lyon and one other one had an increase of 25%. The average across all of them was about 9%. So those are statistics, and those are movements in the right direction.
This is the third legislative session that Republicans will have control of both chambers and the governor's office. A lot of Republican priorities went through in the last couple of sessions. What's left?
Well, there's a lot of things left. We should never stop thinking about what we can do differently. And I can't tell you all the things that are left because I'm going to talk about that and the condition of the state. But a couple of things that I talked about on the campaign trail that I think is really important. You know, we put last year unanimously, we passed Future Ready Iowa because every single legislator was hearing from their constituencies back home. I'm excited about the opportunities. Our business is growing. I need people. I hear it multiple times a day. And so was every legislator. And so for that bill to pass unanimously. We've got kind of the policy in place and the infrastructure, and now we need to put the funding in that will allow us to really, you know, get Iowans the skills that they need so that they can have a great quality of life in Iowa. So that's part of the, really, I think, one of the things that we'll be working on. Same thing with mental health, passed unanimously last year. I'm really proud of the comprehensive mental health reform, identified the barriers, addressed it in a significant piece of legislation, and now we need to make sure that we can sustain that and we can, you know, implement what we passed last legislative session.
Do you think the money's there to implement it?
Well, we're working on that right now. I think, you know, last year when we, with managed care, when we certified the rates in the contracts, a part of that rate took into account the mental health reform that we passed. That was included, some money was included in that. So they actually are moving forward already with a lot of the initiatives that were outlined in that piece of legislation. So we need to take a look at that and see what else we need to do working with the regions and the stakeholders and the providers to make sure that we can sustain that and that we can adequately fund it to really provide Iowans the services that they're looking for.
On your election night acceptance speech, you said you were just getting started with cutting taxes. The latest revenue estimates predicts a little bit of a growth in fiscal year 2020, and some say that that could easily get eaten up by personnel and Medicaid costs. Will you pursue additional tax cuts if that estimate holds true?
Well, you know, timing is yet to be determined, but I'm going to continue to look for ways that we can be more competitive as a state and look for opportunity to have allow Iowans and small businesses and farmers to keep more of their hard-earned money. I mean, that's what we should always be doing as a government. We have certain obligations and responsibilities to the taxpayers of Iowa, but we also, I believe that they're better positioned to decide what they can do with their money and not government. So we'll continue to look. We still, our corporate tax rate, we're still highest, number one, highest in the country. So if we're going to be competitive, we need to take a look at that. But, you know, that involves taking a look at the tax credits, doing the due diligence on that, looking at them holistically, looking for opportunities to maybe streamline some of those while driving down corporate tax rates. Whether that happens this next legislative cycle or the next year, we got 4 years to continue to work on that. But we want to make sure, just like we did with the historic tax reform that we passed, it was significant. It was the largest tax cut in the history of the state, but we did it in a responsible manner, and we did it while maintaining our priorities of education, healthcare, and public safety. And so that will be the same vein that we'll continue to look at as we look at additional tax cuts.
We're coming out of a couple of years of status quo budgets and mid-year budget cuts. Would you say that restoring funding to the agencies that, you know, are saying they badly need it and haven't had enough budget increases in the past few years, would that be a priority over additional tax cuts, or how do you see that working?
Well, it's a combination of both. As I just indicated, we needed to do it in a responsible and thoughtful manner. So as we implemented the largest tax cut, so we gave more, you know, hardworking Iowans and small businesses, allowed them to keep more of their money. We also did it in a manner that we were able to fund our priorities, which is education, healthcare, and public safety. And, you know, we're going to continue as agencies to look for opportunities to do things in a more efficient and effective manner, to look at opportunities to collaborate and use technology, you know. So we'll take a look at what their needs are, how we can continue to be better at what we're doing, to work across agencies, and maybe through collaborative efforts, there's opportunity for us to not only do a better job, but to do it in a more efficient manner as well.
Well, one agency that asked for a status quo budget was the Department of Corrections, but they also indicated that even though they were asking for a status quo budget, they had received additional money this year that was vital to them maintaining staffing levels, and that they really needed extra money in the future too.
Yep. So we work with them, and we'll sit down with them, and we'll take a look at that and see what we can do.
Are you concerned at all that there might be a big incident? You know, it's corrections. It's obviously public safety.
Well,
is a huge issue.
They monitor that all the time, and I have great confidence. Jerry Bartra was the director of corrections. He did a phenomenal job. We'll have an acting director until we can do a national search. But I have the confidence in them that they are looking at the staffing requirements that they need to manage the agency. In addition to that, you know, we want to make sure that we start to limit the number of people that are being incarcerated. And so, again, it goes back to if we can help Iowans get the skills that they need and match them up with a great job, a lot of the other areas, you know, start to take care of themselves. And so we're ready to invest in Iowans, not only in our K-12 educational system, but for our adult learners as well. And really, again, help match them up with, I mean, probably 60,000 jobs on an average daily open in the state of Iowa, and these are good jobs. So the more we can take care of it on the front end, that starts to alleviate some of the pressures that we're seeing in the correctional system. In addition to that, I am so proud. We are leading the country when it comes to offering apprenticeship programs in every one of our correctional institutions. And, you know, that's making sure that when they do have the opportunity to reenter into society, they have a skill. Hopefully, they have a driver's license, and they have an employer that's ready to hire them. And the statistics show that if they have a job and they're reunited with their family, the chances of them recidivism is much lower. And so, you know, you can't just isolate when you're looking at these things. You need to look at it from a holistic perspective and how all of that works together for the system and for Iowans.
Final question here. You recently said you'd be open to looking at changes to how judges are chosen in the state. Is there something about the process that you think is flawed?
Well, I think, you know, right now, 8 of the positions are selected by the bar. And so I think it makes sense for the legislature to take a look at that and review it. And I look forward to seeing what the recommendations are.
All right. Okay. Governor Reynolds, thank you.
Thank you.
Conversation recorded last Thursday. Clay Masters and Katarina Sestarek of IPR talking with Governor Kim Reynolds. Reminder, a conversation with legislative leaders on Monday's program here over the noon hour. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Caitlin Harrop with help from Alyssa Bovinette. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Do tune in for our first Statehouse conversation next Monday.